I'm Robin Daly, Chairman and Founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. Last November, Yes to Life hosted a conference questioning the orthodox thinking and science behind the mechanisms of cancer and thereby the methods used to treat cancer. It was entitled Charging Down the Wrong Path: Is Cancer a Metabolic Epigenetic Disease? Charging Down the Wrong Path is a quote from the esteemed theoretical physicist Paul Davies and is his description of the whole of current cancer research. And we were fortunate enough to be able to open our conference with an especially recorded interview with Paul. The last speaker of the day, who received a standing ovation for her talk, was Jane McClelland, an extraordinary pioneer and 17-year survivor of a stage 4 cancer. Jane told her story and explained the road very much less travelled that she took to achieve such a staggering result. I'm delighted to be able to talk to Jane today over Skype. Hi Jane, lovely to have you on the show again. Thanks very much.
Great to be back.
As I said in my introduction, you were one of the speakers at our conference at the end of last year. We think it was a bit of a landmark event. How important did you think the event was in terms of the overall development of cancer treatment?
With the title being, Is Cancer Charging Down the Wrong Path? Is it a metabolic and epigenetic disease? I think that pretty much summed up the thoughts that all of the speakers had during the day, that we were all coming at it from the metabolic angle in different ways. And it all boiled down to the fact that the focus has been very much on the genetic changes driven by past theories that have looked at the way that viruses affect the genome and particularly the P53 genome. And this has actually just led to a complete focus on therapies like chemotherapy and radiotherapy, which target the rapid reproduction of the DNA itself, but really not looking at other factors of cancer. And of course, cancer is incredibly complex, and completely ignoring other factors that really should be looked at, like the immune system, growth factors, oxygenation, and the metabolism of how the cell actually works. So it's been there are so many areas that should be looked at in cancer research, and these have vastly been ignored. And the quality of the speakers was phenomenal, actually, I have to say, right from getting Paul Davies, who was he appointed by Obama to look at as an independent physicist to look at
by the NCI, the National Cancer Institute. They actually appointed him.
Right. Right. Well, he was fascinating and gave quite a good overview at the start of just how we have been looking at it from this completely wrong angle, and it's been very profit-driven. The big pharmaceutical companies have been all trying to look for this miraculous cure and look for the one drug that's going to be treating everything, and clearly that's been a flawed approach. Otherwise, why haven't we got the cure?
Right. Okay. Well, look, for the listeners who don't know you, who don't know your story, I mean, we had you as a speaker on two counts. One, you class as an extraordinary survivor, definitely up there with those. But also, you've done a massive amount of research on your own account, which has led you to become a bit of a campaigner, really. So can you give us the short story of your own story and how you got to be where you are and exactly what you're pushing for?
Well, gosh, the short story. yes, the shortened version is that I was diagnosed in 1994 with, it was actually stage 3, but they class cervical cancer slightly differently as a result of very bad management, poor diagnosis and treatment. In fact, well, I won't go into that story in too much depth, but shocking, national recall of patients, etc. But anyway, so moving on from there, it then progressed to my lungs in 1999. In the meantime, between 94 and 99, my mother had been diagnosed with late stage breast cancer. And I knew through my medical training, because I'm a physiotherapist, that this really meant that she was going to die, that the medical profession were really just keeping her going for as long as possible, but they didn't expect her to survive. So I was desperate to find anything else that would help. And this was when I came across a lot of research, well, not huge amounts of research, but enough research to persuade me that changing diet and looking at the metabolic angle of cancer was definitely worthwhile. But I suspect it was too late to really have done much for my mum. She didn't last very long. And, you know, I felt seriously let down by the medical profession, because she had been diagnosed initially with a very early stage breast cancer, but she'd never had any earlier chemo or radiotherapy or anything. I think she'd been very let down. So, and when it came back in my lungs, I felt very let down as well. And I'd already started looking, because of my mother's experience, I'd already started looking for alternative treatments. So I'd already started to change my own diet. And because of that, I was able to already be ahead of the game. So when it came to being diagnosed with the secondary in my lung, I was already on the course of sort of reducing the amount of sugar in my diet, inflammatory things in my diet. So I was halfway there, and took it a lot further when I was diagnosed. So that's a short story. But then, I mean, it then developed on from there when I realised that the diet actually wasn't enough. And I was doing many other things as well. I had intravenous vitamin C, loads of supplements. I went to see several complementary doctors. I couldn't rely on just information from one source. I was looking everywhere. I was reading PubMed. I was reading articles in journals, in hospitals, in the NutriCenter. I was looking everywhere. Meanwhile, I was also launching a new business. So I really put myself through it in terms of workload, stress, a bit crazy, really. And frankly, I'm astonished I'm still here, but I am.
A few people are.
But I mean, I was given initially when it got to stage four, and the scary thing is actually just educating yourself. Looking at the statistics were very scary, and with this kind of cancer, you're not expected to live longer than 3-6 months max. So you know, I've done pretty well, because we're now 17 years or so since that time.
So now on to the piece about your campaigny side of what you're doing, where you're actually you're heading up a bit of a movement to try and push things in a particular direction.
Yes, well, I've been sitting back watching the way that the whole cancer industry has been moving in the last 17 years, because I've been helping friends, relatives of friends, and with their individual cancer problems. And I have said to them that I didn't think it was entirely correct that they should be doing just the conventional side. They should be adding the complementary. But another angle that I took was to choose this sort of middle path that nobody else had done before. And I'd never come across anybody else who had used these drugs. And they're known as off-label because they are not really prescribed for cancer as yet. They're not seen as cancer drugs. One of them is a statin. I used lovastatin, and there was some good research that I came across that showed it was particularly good for cervical cancer and head and neck cancers, and achieving long-term stable disease. Even though the tumours weren't actually shrinking, it was achieving long-term stable disease. And that, in fact, if you used a statin in combination with a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, you would increase the effect of both of those. So individually they had anti-cancer effects, but actually if you add them together, the anti-cancer effect was multiplied by a factor of 5. So, you know, 1 and 1 didn't equal 2, you know, it made 10. So this to me was very exciting, that, and then I investigated this a bit further, and I gradually ended up adding several drugs together that are off-label drugs, one on top of the other, but all the way through, what I was doing was charting what I was doing, checking my blood results just to make sure that I was actually not making myself worse and that I was making myself better. And this was incredibly important to me to be looking at the science. So I have been campaigning for this middle road because I've seen the complementary side being, there's been a huge amount of antagonism on both sides of the cancer industry. I can see the conventional side, and I have a family of doctors all saying, you know, that nutrition doesn't matter, that changing your diet is worthless. Nobody thinks there is any sense in doing that. They're not really trained in that area. And then I've got the other side saying, don't touch drugs. You know, they're all bad. They're all going to poison you. They're going to make you worse. So I've seen these two opposing camps at loggerheads, really. And my mission has been trying to sort of go down this middle path to say, there are drugs which are not so toxic that you can use in combination with conventional treatments that will actually assist and make these conventional treatments much better. Now, I felt I've been for many, many years with these friends and friends of friends, and I've been saying to them, can you please, you know, ask for these drugs with your oncologists? And most of them didn't. They didn't have the courage, or they didn't feel educated enough to actually ask for them themselves. So I started going with friends to actually visit the oncologist with them and asking the oncologist direct whether they could prescribe these things. And mostly I was met with a very hostile reception. You know, I struggled. You know, I even had the door shut in my face. And this was the kind of reaction I got. So it was very disheartening. And I found it incredibly, I don't talk about this in my talk at all, but this is in my book that I'm publishing. And this mission that I'm now on is to try and get more people to appreciate the idea of combining treatments and combining chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and these conventional therapies with less toxic drugs that can actually assist, as well as doing natural things and supporting the immune system with supplements and all those other things that provide that holistic support. But it's very much a completely integrative approach that I think is required. And these off-label drugs have really been ignored for many, many years and still are, sadly. And so I started this revolution. I launched my Facebook page in June 2015. And this was as a result of finding a clinic that actually is providing full drugs, very similar to the ones that I used, but another combination. Two of them are the same and two of them are different. And they are getting great results. And I thought, you know what, there's so much information coming out now about some of these other supporting drugs that I need to get the word out. So I started this mission, this revolution, and I haven't done any promotion or anything like that. I'm just shy of 1,000 members now on my site, which is terrific. And it's a mission that's amazing. I mean, yeah, I see too many people dying of cancer all the time, and I just felt something had to change. Enough was enough. I knew there was a better way forward. I think the way that cancer is treated, you know, cancer patients are treated at the moment is entirely wrong. They start with the wrong drugs, they finish with the wrong drugs, and the whole thing should be turned upside down. Almost start with immunotherapies and these lower toxic things, some of the lower toxic drugs first, and then work to doing the more toxic things if it doesn't, you know, if you're not getting the results that you need, rather than this huge panic, which patients are encouraged to sort of go and get rid of their tumours straight away, and the focus is all on shrinking the tumour the whole time, rather than stabilising the tumour, stopping it from growing, and then you can work on reducing it slowly, rather than this massive rush to try and get rid of it, which I don't think is helpful for the patient. I think the psychological aspects are enormous and underestimated by the oncologists generally. I think they don't quite fully appreciate just how devastating a cancer diagnosis is. And it doesn't just affect the cancer patient. It's whole communities are affected. It's the patient, their spouse or their boyfriend or girlfriend, and their children or their parents, brothers and sisters, their friends. It's a massive effect that cancer has, not just on the one person. And it's something that really needs to be addressed properly, to be completely. I would love to get hold of people in charge and just say, look, why don't we try doing it a completely different way? But it's never going to happen, I don't think, which is a great shame. But there are so many articles coming out now which show that low dose chemo is just as effective as high dose. The immunotherapies, if used at the beginning and then followed with surgery, are actually more effective than doing the surgery and then immunotherapies. But it's not, you know, these things are not going to change overnight. So yeah. My Facebook group is really just to bring new publication, you know, new articles that come out and bring them to the attention of patients so that they can educate themselves. Because at the end of the day, the oncologists only know what they're told and what they hear, and they don't hear the full story. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of them are very arrogant and they don't fully listen to the patient. And really, they should be learning a lot from the patient. I know as a physio, I learned an awful lot from my patients. I would always listen to them. And I think I think a physio has a luxury of having a bit more time on their hands to talk to their patients and actually find out what makes them tick, whether they're going to go home and do their exercises or do anything themselves, or what kind of people they really are. Are they adrenaline junkies that are going to go and exercise more than you want them to? Are they going to do less? You know, you have to make all these evaluations of your patient, and you have to look at them as a whole person. And I think that oncologists are very good at depersonalizing. I mean, I'd hate to be an oncologist, you know. I mean, they it's very easy, I think, for them to just see patients as a tumor, a patient with a tumor, rather than an actual person. I mean, it must be a terribly hard job giving people devastating news the whole time. And you have to be a particular type of person to do that job. And it does worry me, and it's a slightly taboo subject, that some of them are too power hungry. And as a physio, I know that it's one of the few areas where other professions don't get involved in decision making about the patient. And because I, as a physio, I've worked alongside orthopaedic surgeons, I've worked alongside neurologists, and, you know, I've stopped patients having major surgery for, you know, for their backs or for their knees even. And I've stopped patients going home too early, saying, give me another 2 weeks and I'll get them on their feet, I'll get them walking with strokes or whatever. And there's always been a sort of a respect between the professions. And I feel that this is almost like the last bastion of medical professions, that the last area where it really hasn't evolved, and that it's been stuck for about the last 50 years doing exactly the same thing. And nothing's moved on. They've not been challenged on what they've been doing, because there's been no interplay with other professions. And really, we've got to see nutritionists getting involved, working alongside oncologists. That is what I think the future should look like. But I think we're a long way off it.
Well, it's hard to argue with a lot of that, Jane.
I'm hoping to interview an oncologist who also would like to see oncologists working alongside nutritionists. How about that? A rare beast indeed.
Who is he?
It's she, and it's not sealed yet. But you know, as soon as I've got the interview in the can, you'll know. Anyway, very exciting. Well, look, you are exemplary when it comes to doing your homework. You've obviously found out a fantastic amount against the odds, and it's really worked for you. And the audience at our conference responded in kind by giving you were the one that got the standing ovation for your talk, and I think it's because of the fact that you've actually you know, in terms of saving your life, you've done the most amazing job and gone above and beyond, you know, what most people would do, but also you've turned that around and you're now using what you've got to help other people, that information, which is brilliant. And we'll get some more details of the things you spoke about at the end of the program, your book, your Facebook group. Now, back to the conference. Now, there's a very wide range of speakers at this conference coming from all sorts of very different angles. Apparently, you know, to an outsider, it might look difficult to see how these all hung together, but they did. Yeah. And do you want to have a bit of a say about how they hung together and also how what they had to say affected your views of the world of cancer?
Well, it didn't change my views. It just reaffirmed my thoughts on the evolutionary roots, which is pretty much what Paul Davis was talking about at the beginning of the conference. Reverting back, the cells almost revert back to a primitive form where they're respiring, they're using their energy in a sort of a anaerobic way, so a lower amount of oxygen, which was initially how the world developed, with a very low amount of oxygen. And then bacteria evolved, which could then start using oxygen. And these then got engulfed, I can't remember how many billion years ago, about 9 billion years ago or something, that you then got this symbiosis of mitochondria, which are ancient bacteria inside another cell. And they work symbiotically to provide energy for each other and to help each other. So then that was your first fusion, and that led to multicellular organisms. So that was sort of an explanation of maybe what happens with cancer, is that the cell reverts back. It sort of switches off some of these more evolutionary advanced genomes that deal with using oxygen, and revert it back to using anaerobic conditions, and it's that was very interesting. And then Travis Christofferson, who I'd spoken to a few times already on Skype and by email, it was great to meet him. He's threatened to send my talk viral when it goes out on video, so yikes. But he loved my talk, but his was great. He mentioned the importance of IGF-1, which is insulin-like growth factor, and that's effect on cancer and how it helps drive the cancer. And this is recognized by, and it has been really recognized by the oncology profession, that this is a major driving factor. It's a growth factor, and it helps glucose get into the cell. So it's how you can say that glucose and IGF and all these things are not interlinked. Of course they are. And if you're going to try and stop one, you've got to try and stop the other. There's no point going half-heartedly with cancer. You've got to approach it from many different angles. So I thought he was brilliant. Obviously he's brilliant. And his book is brilliant, and he's just about to bring out his latest version of Tripping Over the Truth. I get a little mention in his in the new epilogue of his book, which is great, explaining my metabolic approach using the drugs. But anyway, so then we followed with Rob Verkerk, who is a champion for natural health and products and championing people's rights. And he's been long involved with the field of oncology and the genetic changes that happen and why we've been looking at these as a primary cause rather than looking at the metabolic side and how the cancer proliferates, really. And that was great because that illustrated to me the use of the energy. So that was important for some of the things that I did, which was to try and block the energy that the cancer cell needs, because in order to replicate, to produce its daughter cells, requires an awful lot of energy, which it gets predominantly from, initially from glucose. And some cancer cells then use an amino acid called glutamine. And I don't think many people know that fact. I think a lot of people are still focused on the glucose aspect, and they haven't quite moved on from that to look at this amino acid glutamine. So that was fascinating. And then, so in the morning, it was very much a science. This is the science. And then the afternoon, the practical side was Dr. Ndaba Mazibuko, who was from the Care Oncology Clinic. And this was the clinic that I discovered in 2015, which was using these drugs very in a similar way to me, which was amazing. I mean, when I discovered them, I sort of danced and cried. I was so happy. So he was talking about the drugs and repurposing the drugs. Metformin, statin, they use those two, as I did. And then they use mebendazole, which is an anti-worming pill, and doxycycline. And they were talking about how everybody at some point discussed the expense of developing new drugs and how it's become so prohibitive that almost Big Pharma have shot themselves in the foot, that they can't even do the randomized clinical trials to get these new drugs into past phase one almost. So, and I think only about 5% of new drugs are now making it past a phase one trial. So, but he was talking about in a clinical way and showing some results from using these drugs with patients. And I think that is very important for a cancer patient to see the results that you can get by using these drugs. So that was great. And then Patricia, well, she's an amazing woman. Patricia Daly is a nutritionist, and she focuses very much on the keto diet, which reduces glucose, and it's very much focused on a sort of a high fat and also a controlled protein intake. But she's not completely fixed on one idea. I like the fact that she's quite flexible and not completely dogmatic about the approach, and she caters for different types of cancers and tweaks it to suit different types of cancers and different metabolisms, which I think is the way forward. And an individual dietary approach has to be the way forward, and different cancers metabolize in different ways. So you can't treat them all the same way. There has to be variation on what you do. And this is very, so this is where I think things will develop in the future with individual dietary advice.
And of course, Patricia is also come from a similar story to you, in as much as her own personal experience of cancer that took her down this road.
Yes, she had cancer herself. Yes. So again, a remarkable story, and I think it's very inspiring for patients to really have not. I mean, these are anecdotal reports. Both mine and hers could almost be seen as anecdotal, but we also have the science to back up what we did. And then, you know, last of all was me talking about my story. I wanted to try and tie up everything that had gone before. So I didn't want to make it too sciencey. You'd had all that. And I just wanted to make it very much a story, my personal journey. And I just wanted to piece together and sort of weave the medical information into my story so it became different. It was definitely a different kind of talk, and I think it was, I mean, I know it was well received, but I think it was hopefully going to get people to realize there is so much more you can do, even if the oncologist has said to you, there's nothing more we can do, sorry, go home. Bet you they haven't tried off-label drugs. Bet you they haven't tried low-dose chemo in conjunction with off-label drugs. I'm sure, you know, there's a whole host of other things, and it's finding this middle path. At the moment, the treatments seem to be either to over-treat you with your maximum tolerated dosage of chemo, or then they give you palliative chemo. You know, it seems to be, it veers from too much to too little, and there seems to be very little in the middle. And it worries me that, you know, people are now saying stage four, chemo is a complete waste of time. I don't think it is a complete waste of time, but I fear we're going to go from giving some to giving absolutely none at all. And that to me is a worry, because I think there is that middle ground where a low dose can be very useful, doesn't suppress the immune system in the same way, because that's critical. You need to keep the immune system going. And this is the problem with chemo, is that it does switch it off. And I had high dose chemo with stage four. Fortunately, with the diet and finding the drugs, I was able to give myself enough time for my immune system to recover. But not everybody has the luxury of, and I was very lucky in the fact that I was medically trained. I could read these journals. I could read information in a way that a normal layperson can't. You know, they don't. A lot of the lingo is very exclusive to the medical profession and means nothing to the ordinary person on the street. You know, so it's incredibly hard for anybody to fully understand how to treat themselves unless they've got some kind of medical training, and it's frightening. Okay. So, you know, I was lucky that I had that training. And, you know, I credit my mum, actually. Said, I mean, she died almost to sort of teach me what to do. So she was definitely somebody who had a massive influence in my survival. And if she hadn't had cancer, I don't think I would be here. So thanks, Mum.
Interesting, so, eh? Well, I think you're right. Your background's enormously helpful to you. I think nowadays there's a more chance that people can get help with the science that they don't understand themselves than you could have 20 years ago. So, things have improved in that way, which is great. They can actually be supported in making good choices. Yes, we certainly, one of the main reasons we had you at the conference was because the kind of reality check of a real person who actually has done this stuff and they're still there alive and looking healthy, you can't beat it at the end of the day, particularly when, you know, the larger part of our audience is the public, where, you know, okay, science is great and you want things to be science-based, but at the end of the day, the best science doesn't always turn out so good in reality. It looks good on paper, but the results are not that good. So I think it's a very important aspect for inspiration, if nothing else.
Well, hopefully it was inspirational. Certainly the reaction was great. So, I mean, I'd practice the talk only to my husband and to a friend. And even when I'd practice it to my husband, he went, wow, did we really do all that? Did we? And I said, well, it wasn't you. It was me. It was me. I did all that. You were sort of mostly on the sort of side watching. And it's quite a turbulent story from diagnosis all the way through. And it's not just about the cancer. It's about the whole psychological effect and how it was, you know, affected my fertility and it affected all sorts of my relationships. And I hope if this ever gets into the hands of oncologists, or if anybody in the medical profession sees it, it just hopefully will be a bit of a wake-up call to try and say, you know, we should be looking at the patient as a whole and not just focusing on shrinking that damn tumour. Why not look instead at sort of stabilising the disease, and instead of, you know, charging at it with all guns blazing, that we should be taking a much more measured approach and doing things slowly, allowing our system to gradually, you know, cancer develops over many, many years. Even very fast growing tumours normally have been developing for some time before that, and then suddenly they click into sort of this fast reproduction. But there's always other problems that have happened way before. And it's trying to rebalance the system in a far more measured and less aggressive fashion that I think is the way forward in the future. But I think we're so far off that. It's going to be a long time before we get to that point, sadly.
Hopefully not.
In the meantime, you know, well, that's part of my mission, part of your mission. You've written a book about revolution, and I'm trying my revolution. So your book was Cancer Revolution, which is a fantastic resource for people, and they should buy it. And, you know, hopefully people will be buying my book, which will go far more into detail but hopefully in an accessible way. I don't want to be talking too much sciencey stuff. I want people to understand and fully grasp the story and to really engage with why things worked and why things didn't and what it can do for them. And it's not just about my type of cancer, because these drugs work on the metabolism, and the metabolism of cancer is every single type of cancer has an altered metabolism. So, you know, these drugs will work for every single type to a greater or lesser degree. And this is where I think the Care Oncology Clinic are terrific, because they're gathering data on all these patients. And this will give us information as to which drugs work better. And they're starting to accrue. I mean, they've been going now over 2 years, and they are starting to find out, you know, which ones respond better to the statin, say, and which ones respond better to the metformin. And I use one called dipyrimal, which hardly anybody knows. And this was a drug in the 1980s that the drugs reps used to actually even say, not that I was around at that time, but they used to say to oncologists that it was good for cancer. But then as soon as the patent expired, they stopped all of that. And then it became a drug that they tried for HIV patients, and they tried it along AZT, and because it has antiviral effects, it's also an MMP9 inhibitor, which is a sort of another growth factor. It's a platelet drive growth factor inhibitor as well. There are lots of reasons why dipyrimal is great, and this is all part of, well, I didn't talk about all of that in my talk. I tried to keep it fairly simple, but it's all about starving the cancer of what it needs to reproduce, because cancer is effectively a cell that tries to proliferate in an uncontrolled way, and it proliferates and reproduces. It produces its daughter cells from the mother cell by rapidly reproducing, and to do that it needs energy, and to do that it also needs the building blocks. And for building blocks, I mean that the cell membrane is essentially a lipid membrane, and inside you have lots of proteins, all sorts of various proteins, and these are made up of various amino acids. So my approach, and I put up my little theory in the talk, the McClelland theory of starving the cancer, was by using metformin or berberine, which is what I used, as well, lovastatin, which will stop the cholesterol, and dipyrimal, which actually works by holding on to a nucleoside, and specifically adenosine, which makes up sort of part of the building blocks of DNA. And unless a cell can actually produce its daughter cells, if it doesn't have those building blocks, it can't proliferate. So it's actually cytostatic. So that means it keeps the cell in a particular size. It doesn't reduce it or allow it to grow, it just sort of stops it from growing, rather than cytotoxic, which is sort of causing the shrinkage and the cell to die. So it's a different way and a slower way to do it, but you get to the end result eventually. But you need a bit more patience, you need faith that it's going to work, and you know you need the cooperation of everybody, really, to make it. It's not just the drugs. And a lot of people, because of my Facebook group, which is Jane McClelland Off-Label Drugs for Cancer, people think that I'm all about just the drugs, but that's not the case at all. You know, the diet was hugely important, and so was blocking growth factors with various supplements and other you know, hormone modulation, angiogenesis inhibitors, exercise, all sorts of different things came into my approach. And it wasn't just about these off-label drugs, but I think during my talk you see how effective they were, because I've got graphs that show when I added things in and exactly what happened to my markers, and I think people found that incredibly useful.
I think, apart from anything else, of course, it's much better. All the other things you spoke about are much better documented and known. The off-label drugs is not particularly spoken about anywhere, and not so well known. So it does need a little bit of extra coverage for sure. I think
well, they're cheap.
Yes, they're cheap.
So there's no money in it, and nobody's really looking at them because there's no profit to be made. So that they aren't going to be use unfortunately, because from a business model, you know, they've got to be added into everything else, and I'm hoping that the care oncology will continue to flourish. So
yeah, public demand will give them a place, just as they do for supplements, which are equally not huge money spinners like drugs. So I think it's interesting, everything you said ties back into the kind of way that cancer is looked at. Paul Davies, in his opening interview there, spoke about the fact that we've all got cancer all the time, and the fact that that isn't the problem. The problem is when it runs away and is out of control. And even then, it doesn't become a problem, usually, of any real medical sort until the very, very late stages. And he spoke about we can all live with cancer quite comfortably. So controlling cancer becomes the new important target, rather than eradicating it. And that's very, very different. And of course, it leads you to do very different things. And it stops being maybe quite the emergency it was, and becomes a bit more of a measured process, as you've described. And of course, there are lots and lots of strategies for controlling growth. They may not get rid of it, but does that matter? If you control it long enough that you die from something else first, you've done a good job, really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I have completely eradicated, I doubt it. I'm sure I've still probably got some cancer in my body, but it doesn't bother me. Mm. I'm not scared of cancer anymore. It's not something I am fearful of anymore. Mm. And to have, you know, after the scary terminal diagnosis and everything, it's for me to say that is quite a big thing. Mm. So it's a bit like, and you can now control HIV sort of over a lifetime by having, constantly having to take drugs, but in a way I see that cancer should be managed in a very similar way, in that you can take a combination of drugs to control it and you can live a normal life, but you just got to remember to take these things and be vigilant and to lower your glucose intake and to improve the metabolism of your body. And there are various things that you should be doing or taking to that maybe you may be lacking that will help that. But those all need checking by proper nutritionists and things. And actually, talking about that, I'm going to formalise my training in that from, you know, the University of Life and School of Hard Knocks doesn't quite give you the qualifications that you need. So I'm actually going to go back to studying and get myself a nutritional diploma as well.
Brilliant.
So that at some point, hopefully, I can actually work alongside an oncologist, and I'll keep pushing for these off-label drugs, because I do feel that this is this middle path that is completely ignored by the oncology profession. And hopefully with more patients being treated and they can see the results actually before their eyes, patients surviving many, many months longer than they expect, years even. I've got people on my site, and people can happily go and join my Facebook group and read these people's stories for themselves. You know, please join my site. It's loads of free information about these off-label drugs and different ones that can be better for various different cancers, because, of course, some of them are more inflammatory than others, so you might need non-steroidal inflammatory alongside some of these other drugs, things like colon cancer, for example, is quite inflammatory, and a non-steroidal called Sulindac has been shown to be very useful for that, whereas ketorolac is more useful possibly for ovarian. I used etodolac, which is another arthritis drug, because cervical cancer is also inflammatory. And it's just looking at different factors and tweaking these things, and trying, you know, it's just empowering the patient. Because if you rely on the oncology profession at the moment, you're really not going to win. Unfortunately, they haven't got the answers at the moment for stage four. They do expect you to die at some point. They won't tell you that. But I don't believe that stage four is terminal at all. You know, here I am, stage four, 17 years later, and I'm quite sure that many, many stage four cancer patients can be saved using these off-label drugs. I'm quite convinced, looking at the data and looking at the way that people respond, that the future is actually looking good for cancer. It's just we need to change the attitudes of the oncologists to not just looking at these monotherapies, but using combinations together, because that's the future is looking in combinations. And of course, Big Pharma trying to push the expensive immunotherapy drugs, and they're combining those, but that requires it ends up with a high level of toxicity, which you don't need. You don't need to have that level of toxicity. These drugs might give you a bit of diarrhea, maybe a bit of a headache to start with, but this normally passes over, you know, a couple of weeks. Once the body is, it actually helps the body. All of these drugs are beneficial in actually helping to correct the gut flora, for helping to break down any tiny little mini clots that you might have. So there are lots of reasons why people should be looking at these drugs, and they are currently ignored, sadly.
Very interesting. Well, of course, you're up against resistance from both sides of the the great cancer war. You've got resistance from oncologists and resistance from sort of natural therapy enthusiasts. So it's a tough one.
It's quite, you know, that's why I've been so quiet, Robin, for many, many years. And I've sort of almost just recently come out of the closet, as it were, with these off-label drugs because I had this clinic to back up, and suddenly there's science, these articles coming out in the journals about all these, about metformin and statins in particular. But doxycycline will actually reach these stem cells, and metformin reaches the stem cells. These are cheap old drugs that are not these huge expensive immunotherapies, and to actually reach the stem cells where chemo and radio fail, you know, they just don't get to the root causes of the problem. And if you can give the treatments for long enough, you know, you have every chance of overcoming the disease, even with a very late stage, as long as you haven't got too much organ damage. I think people, as long as they really approach it in the right way and not just use the drugs, but they alter their diet, they help their immune system by altering their gut flora, because that's critical for the immune system. And there's a lot of research coming out about the microbiome. Dr. David Perlmutter has written some great books. Tim Spector is fully on the microbiome as well. There's some fantastic resources to read about the microbiome and how critical it is for your health and for your long-term. And it's particularly important for your immunity, which is ultimately what you need to overcome cancer, because it's all about your body recognizing the cancer and teaching your body to overcome it itself. And not just going for the kill with these drugs. You've actually got to re-educate and rehabilitate your own body. And just pouring all this toxic sludge into yourself is not going to do it. It's just defeating the ultimate purpose of allowing the body to get rid of the cancer itself and get back into a homeostasis of being able to cope with a certain amount of cancer in the body. and get rid of it. I mean, frankly, it's you know, people say, oh, we have cancer in the body all the time. Yes, we do, but the level of mutations are very, very low. You know, it's just sudden triggers that reach the tipping point, and then cancer becomes slightly uncontrollable, and it's just keeping it before it gets to that tipping point, and maintaining that homeostasis, that balance in the body where you are in good health.
Okay, well, look, I hope some of our listeners will appreciate that there's maybe a whole new world of resources there to help them, particularly those people who are kind of notionally somewhere near the end of the road from an orthodox point of view.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great. Thank you very much for sharing all that. I think we're just about out of time. Why don't you just quickly tell us about your book that's coming up and repeat the details about your Facebook group.
The details on the book, still in negotiation with publishers, but most likely going to be called How I Starved Cancer, because the whole ethos of what I did, and it is my story from diagnosis, infertility, a sort of a real tragedy to triumph with all sorts of things in the meantime, sort of being on Dragon's Den with stage four and all sorts of things that happened during that time. It was challenging, but it's really my story, and then the use of off-label drugs as well, and weaving in that medical approach of hitting the Achilles heel of the energy of cancer, that is what all cancers need, is the energy to reproduce, and that's actually starving the cancer in that way, so that you're depleting its ability to get hold of the glutamine, which can make nucleosides for the DNA. It's depleting its ability to use the energy from glucose, and it's depleting the ability to get hold of cholesterol to make new cell walls. So it's very much as starving the cancer, and that makes it very weak. And then you can then add all these other, and this is what I did. I didn't use chemo afterwards, but I certainly used berberine, which is very similar to metformin. And I discuss, not in huge detail, but I do a synopsis of the drugs at the end, so that people have got that medical information as to why they work. So, yeah, it's essentially my story to where I am today.
And when do you expect that to come out?
I would say definitely by the middle of this year.
Yeah.
Great. I've got a new web page which I'm building, which will have a lot of resources for some looking at how you can starve cancer, as well as my Facebook group. So that's going to be called howtostarvecancer.com. So my Facebook group, which anybody's welcome to join, you know, if you're just interested, as well as patients, obviously. That's Jane McClelland, and that's McLelland, off-label drugs for cancer.
Okay, brilliant.
Quite a long-winded title.
Not to worry, easy to find though. Great. All right, we're going to have to leave it there, Jane. It's been really fascinating. Thanks very much for the big update on your whole story, and also for being such a key part of our event last year, which is great.
Well, it was a fantastic event. I think you got an amazing group of people together, and all credit to your organisation, which does a fantastic job. And I know that you raise money to get people through the care oncology as well. So that's terrific. So big thank you from me as well.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Jane.
Nice to talk to you, Robin. Bye.
You'll shortly have the opportunity to hear the whole of Jane's talk, along with all the other talks from the Yes to Life conference, as they will be available to buy as video downloads from the Cancer Revolution website. That's thecancerrevolution.co.uk within the next few days. And in next week's show, by way of a taster for these videos, I shall be broadcasting extracts from all the talks, including Jane's. As usual, you can find links to material from today's show at yestolife.org.uk. Click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choose UK Health Radio. You can keep up with the charity Yes to Life and with me, Robin Daly, during the week on social media. And I hope you'll join me again for next week's show. Goodbye.